are listening to the eFlux podcast.
In today's episode, Art in General curator and director Laurel Patak talks to artist and writer Zach Blass on the occasion of his exhibition Contra Internet at Art in General, on view through April 21st, and his lecture performance Metric Mysticism at eFlux.
So Zach, I'm wondering if we could maybe start by talking a little bit about this concept of Contra Internet. That's part of your recent work and exhibition project that we just got to work on together that opened at Art in General. And I'm thinking, I guess, as an overarching framework for the work that you've been doing for the past while, this kind of mode of thinking through text and thinking through sort of various ideas that come from, I don't know, maybe like a theoretical background that isn't always associated with work that's trying to look critically at the internet. And the way that you kind of fuse those two discourses has been really interesting to follow in your work. Could you talk a little bit about Contra Internet as a concept and kind of some of the reference points for that and how you see it kind of connecting together maybe some ideas about queer and feminist thought in relationship to technology?
Why, of course I can. I think, for a long time, you know, I've been, you know, trying to do work that's really kind of engaging science and technology from queer and feminist perspectives. And I think, I had been working on Contra Internet, the broader project, for a number of years. And I think a huge part of that was, you know, finding different ways, whether they're theoretical, playful, experimental, you know, different kind of artistic modalities of, bringing together different strands of queer and feminist thought that might not be interested in technology or the internet. And, you know, trying to find a way to, bring those things together. And also think, a big part of that for me is the commitment to a certain history of queer and feminist thought, and finding ways to bring that to bear on certain kind of contemporary questions feels really important to what I'm doing. But I think before I dive into the Contra Internet, I guess what I would, as a concept, I would like to frame that by discussing utopian plagiarism. And utopian plagiarism is something that I learned about from Ricardo Dominguez, who is one of my art mentors and probably one of the most important artists that I've ever encountered in my life as a young person. And Ricardo always, talked about this idea, and I was always, you know, really inspired by it because it was just such a like interesting, fun, playful way of engaging with theory that wasn't just kind of scholarly or academic. And Critical Art Ensemble, Ricardo was a part of Critical Art Ensemble at one point, and they wrote a chapter on utopian plagiarism in one of their books. I think it's The Electronic Disturbance. And basically, this would be, you know, taking a concept, doing a kind of fast experimentation with it, whether it would be, you know, marking out a word, adding something, kind of tweaking a concept to see if they could kind of open it to like new possibilities of thought. And I think they most famously did this, Critical Art Ensemble did, with electronic civil disobedience. So this idea, you know, always kind of sat with me over the years. And one day I found myself reading Paul Preciado's Contrasexual Manifesto. And all of a sudden I just started kind of replacing sexual with internet as I was reading this text. And I found that really interesting and provocative and exciting. And even though I didn't fully understand, what that meant, I wanted to embark on a pathway of trying to figure that out. So for Preciado, contrasexuality, you know, it doesn't necessarily, or it doesn't refer to, you know, the sense of being, you know, against all sexuality in some kind of puritanical, totalized sense. It's, you know, suggesting, right, it's kind of classically queer engagement with sexuality. And what one of the really amazing parts of this manifesto is that it really kind of celebrates the dildo. And the dildo in this manifesto is not something that can be collapsed into patriarchy, right? It's not a symbol for patriarchy. It's not the same thing as a penis. And right, thinking about this idea of contrasexuality and its kind of firm stance against these kind of naturalized interpretations of sexuality, moving that into the internet, again, I think that the idea of the contra internet isn't about a sense of having a kind of, I guess, totalized refusal of the internet. It's more about you know, thinking about the internet as something, a kind of, I guess, a larger condition, you know, maybe a condition that's something more than just infrastructure, mm-hmm. that is becoming kind of naturalized or seemingly totalized in the world. And, you know, what would it mean to take this kind of position that tries to engage with that through critical principles that are attached to, you know, queer and feminist politics? And I think that could look kind of like different things. Like maybe on the one hand, early inspiration for thinking about the contra-internet was actually certain activist projects around the world that were developing, that still are developing infrastructural alternatives So I think one kind of small example, but I think a really important one that happened in New York was the artist and technologist Dan Pfeiffer, when he made this little kind of autonomous darknet that activists could use in Zuccotti Park as a way to kind of, again, communicate without certain kinds of interference. And then there's another interesting group of people in Detroit called the Digital Stewards that do certain kinds of community work around building mesh networks for people. So, yeah, just kind of generally different infrastructural projects that are thinking about, you know, how communities can have some kind of like autonomous engagement with infrastructure. Like, I think that's really exciting and inspiring. And, you know, maybe on a more conceptual sense, or even like actually the sense of political desire, what I think is really exciting about those is that it shifts the horizon of what seems possible, you know, that it kind of fractures this idea of just the totalized view of the internet, which is like that view is the view that, you know, that Silicon Valley entrepreneurs give us. I think of the ex-CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, you know, when he was asked to kind of predict the future of the internet at the World Economic Forum a few years ago. And he says, you know, the internet will disappear into the world. So, you know, his kind of view is as the Internet of Things kind of further disperses, that the internet as we know it will collapse into the world, and then there will no longer be a distinction between the world and the internet. They're the same thing. So I think these kind of alternative infrastructure projects help fracture that logic or that kind of belief or ideology in the world and the internet kind of totalizing into one another.
Yep.
And they just kind of, even if these are small, localized practices that are actually quite limited maybe in what they can do technically and practically, I still just think they're kind of important, again, at this level of like political desire about when you look to the horizon of possibility, like what actually, you know, what do you feel can actually be achieved? And I think they're really exciting and important and really inspiring.
Another reference in the work that is interesting to think about in light of how you're discussing things is the J.K. Gibson Graham reference. And so these are feminist economists who write collectively under one name. And you've kind of performed utopian plagiarism with some of their texts as well. They've always been really interesting to me as kind of, you know, writers and thinkers, because they find this really interesting position sort of between academic discourse and almost activist discourse in their work, their kind of work that has focused on post-capitalism. And so I'm kind of wondering how you take up those strands of feminist economy and what you kind of do with their thinking as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think J.K. Gibson Graham's book, The End of Capitalism as We Know It, is certainly another kind of big inspiration for the project. And again, I think, you know, it's kind of connected to pretty much what I was saying, that there's something about, you know, the way that J.K. Gibson Graham kind of frame this critique of actually how the academic left has set up capitalism is actually a theoretical and political problem that needs to be undone. And, you know, really, like, there's something so incredible, like, powerful about that critique of, you know, their kind of frustration with a left that sets up capitalism as that which can have no outside. Yeah. And then when you actually kind of do that theoretical setup, you know, then right there, their kind of point is, well, if you kind of totalize capitalism, you can never arrive at the anti-capitalist alternative that you're supposedly kind of after and seeking.
Yep.
So, again, like, I feel like, you know, what Preciado was doing with kind of, you know, kind of demanding these like breaking down of kind of naturalized sexuality and actually finding playful experimental ways to kind of get at contrasexuality with the dildo, you know, I see, you know, a kind of alignment with J.K. Gibson Graham, maybe at the level of the economic, when they're talking about certain kinds of economic practices that they see, you know, in existence within this supposedly totalized frame of capitalism. Well, I mean, I don't, they wouldn't call it this, but, you know, maybe if you want to kind of mash up Gibson Graham and Preciado, it would be like contra-economic practices or something like that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think for me, I remember reading that book and it was my imagination of things to do with capitalism and those kind of simple shifts that they make to allow us to think outside of it. And also, I think, like, offer kind of really practical ways in everyday life to make sense of this. And I really kind of admire that as like a tool that they're giving to people to kind of carry forward. And I'm sort of thinking about your work with like the contra internet in that same way. It's been interesting, like, talking to you about sort of how that term and that phrase that you've developed in relationship to this body of work has had a, like, a life of its own. And on the one hand, you know, I read that as you maybe trying to offer a kind of critical refusal of post-internet discourse. But that also, it's just interesting to see how it's almost a phrase or a concept that we need at this moment and that people really want to formulate or have this desire. We have this shared desire to formulate something contra to these structures. And I wonder if you could, talk a little bit about that.
One thing maybe I could say is that, I mean, maybe this seems like a really simple point, but it's also, you know, kind of doing this utopian plagiarism and even thinking about in the film that we'll talk about soon, where the kind of like contra prophet figure, if you will, in the film is reading from a book called The End of the Internet as We Knew It. And I think part of that, like this linking of how J.K. Gibson Graham are theorizing capitalism and the internet, it just seems, you know, those are actually so kind of deeply connected today. So what's incredible is, like, actually this work written in the 90s, so kind of the critique so beautifully kind of fits and matches the kind of critique that we could make around the internet. So I think just that linking together, I found, like, really, really productive. And I think often, I mean, the way that I like to think that I work as someone that makes artwork and writes is that I really do try and make work around concepts, and often I'll actually start from the place of thinking or trying to kind of figure out a concept, and that becomes a kind of discursive frame to start making around. But it was nice to hear you say that, because I definitely don't feel it. I don't kind of want ownership of those concepts. You know, I really like the idea of making them and that they can have this kind of, you know, life, like, beyond the work that I attach to them. And I think that's really important. And, you know, maybe one way that I see that is, you know, maybe it's kind of pushing along certain histories with feminism and queerness and technology, you know, maybe something like cyberfeminism, for instance, where if you look at some of that work in the 90s, there was a more kind of celebratory engagement with the internet and the World Wide Web, and that kind of as a site of potential feminist or queer liberation. Yeah. Whereas it just seems like that critique, right, needs to kind of shift, and a more critical lens needs to be brought to those questions today. But I do feel like it's in line with those, like, longer histories of thinking about these technologies.
Yeah, I mean, I love that about your work, that it kind of connects us to that history, which, you know, isn't completely lost, but I feel is sort of not as well understood as it should be. I think, you know, it's really interesting to think back to that moment where there were sort of like artists, theorists, writers who were developing ideas, you know, in contrast to the, you know, mainstream internet that was sort of developing around them. So they were, you know, at this point in time in which these more sort of like DIY tools that were available to people who kind of bothered to get to know how to use them were really being transformed into this, you know, quote unquote, internet superhighway or information superhighway, or these funny clumsy ways of, you know, how people were trying to, like, imagine that in the 90s. But this moment of, you know, when the shift came between those sort of DIY tools that people could use in their own ways that sort of came from, you know, originally military technology, then kind of handed over to the university to develop. But people were starting to take those things up. And then there was this infusion of, like, capital and this kind of moment in which those things were becoming transformed into, I think, the kind of internet that you're critiquing today. And I love that. I love digging back into that kind of 90s history of cyberfeminism, because you just see they predicted everything that was all the evil things that were about to happen so early on, and that was so grounded in a kind of like, you know, feminist and queer perspective, I think is really interesting to think about that history as one that also continues to be undervalued, I would say, and is still like a project that is dramatically under-historicized, considering how relevant it is both to kind of what matters today in contemporary art, but also what matters today in relationship to kind of technology in a broader sense. And I think, you know, we met in a moment when I was kind of really trying to think through those histories, and you had developed all these sort of playful projects already that were trying to use those tools in like very interesting ways. So I always love that sort of older strain of your work that was trying to think these things through, the queer technologies projects that you did, and other things that I feel like gave you this like amazing foundation to do this kind of work that you're doing now. And maybe that's a really good kind of segue to start to talk about the film that you just finished, Jubilee 2033, and kind of how that as an artwork, as a film, how it kind of dives into some of these, you know, more contemporary questions about technology, and maybe how you see that film fitting into these larger questions around contra-internet.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, with the film, it's funny because I guess I feel like I chose to kind of dive back a little deeper than when I guess was a student of all of this kind of work from the 90s that just so kind of deeply marked me with tactical media and hacktivism and cyberfeminism. Before all of that, I studied film. And I think, you know, what happened with the film was like, as I was diving into these questions around the contra internet and thinking about, you know, questions of the internet and control, and I had made, like, as you said, you know, work in the past that, you know, maybe had functioned as kind of sometimes political tools, but also somewhere between like conceptual objects. And I actually really struggled with trying to think about, you know, what can I do? Like, how can I kind of engage with these really complicated questions, like within that framework? And to be honest, like, I really just felt quite stumped. And
Why stumped?
I felt stumped in the sense of, like, I guess thinking about, you know, these like hacktivism and tactical media, just the kind of, I guess, the pressure to make a tool, this kind of pressure to make something that has some kind of very clear designated like use value that instigates a kind of intervention, let's say, with out of the frame as kind of like art as we know it. And I think I just wanted to be honest with myself about, you know, I didn't know what to do with this concept. So what ended up happening was that I found myself kind of looking back to earlier interests and earlier training I had in film. And suddenly that just really clicked for me that, you know, maybe film could be a medium where I could actually really explore a lot of these ideas, you know, beyond the pressure of trying to make some kind of tool, but still kind of stay in line and connected to, you know, the like longer work I've been making around queerness and feminism and technology. And, you know, where I ended up landing is this engagement with the British queer filmmaker Derek Jarman, particularly his film right from 1978, Jubilee. And the funny thing about Jubilee is that it's a film that I feel like has really haunted pretty much everything I've made since I've seen it.
Really?
So you see it in the queer technologies work with the gay bomb, because the way that I kind of thought about the gay bomb, one of the examples that I always loved with the gay bomb is in Jubilee, which kind of takes place in this in late 70s in London, which is rendered somewhat post-apocalyptic, and you have this queer gang. And one of the members of the queer gang, she kind of breaks from them and sleeps with a cop. And there's a moment where, you know, she's lying in bed with this cop fantasizing about this kind of like heteronormative life that she would like to have. But it's a post-apocalyptic kind of a scenario. So that's not really possible to achieve anyway. And the doorbell rings, the cop goes and answers the front door, and Bod, the leader of the queer gang, you know, throws this Molotov cocktail at him and yells, "No future." Mm-hmm. And of course, I think that's kind of riffing off of the Sex Pistols, but it's interesting that it also connects to a well-known queer theory book by Lee Edelman called No Future, about queer theory and the death dot drive. And part of that is about queerness is that which should refuse, you know, kind of this like, I'm kind of forgetting exactly how he phrases it, but this idea of it's reproductive futurity, mm-hmm. that like politics are always in the service of the child, mm-hmm. that's kind of the drive of like political change. Mm-hmm. Anyway, just, you know, there's the gay bomb from Jubilee. Anyway, it's just like creeped up in a lot of ways. And I just felt that what would be really amazing is to just take this structure and work with it, because I don't know if Jubilee is really thought of like this, but in a lot of ways it is a science fiction film because it deals with time travel and it's about Queen Elizabeth I traveling into the future to kind of see the wreckage of England that she is kind of complicit within. And, you know, I thought a lot about, you know, queer temporality and actually how what's amazing about Jubilee is that, you know, ultimately it's a film that's about, you know, critiquing political leaders. Yep. Right. And yeah, kind of things that they set in motion. And I just thought that the structure would be really amazing to work with. And I think, you know, maybe also because, you know, one of the characters in Jarman's Jubilee that I was always so kind of taken by was this character amyl nitrate. And what's incredible is in that film, one of the first things when Queen Elizabeth travels into the future, one of the very first places she's taken to is an all autonomous women's center. And, you know, you have this like, this character Mad with a machine gun, introducing amyl nitrate, who is described as, you know, the heroine of this scenario. And actually, Derek Jarman in the script described her, amyl nitrate, as the historian of the void. And anyway, amyl nitrate then kind of delivers this like art and history lesson about England and art and desire and reality. And I was so kind of captivated by amyl nitrate. Yeah. And then, you know, what happened one day was I was talking about amyl nitrate with a friend of mine, Castles, who's this performance artist based in LA. And Castles said to me, you know, if you ever want me to be your amyl nitrate, you just tell me. And honestly, that, you know, really kind of set everything into motion. But gosh, I mean, Jube, it's such a big topic. Maybe you should guide me a little with where to go next.
I mean, I think what's so interesting about the kind of, you know, film that you've made, Jubilee 2033, which maybe is another kind of gesture of utopian plagiarism for you. I love the way that what it, you know, takes as its starting point is to imagine the Silicon Valley of the future. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can just take us a little bit through some of the ideas in the film that stem from that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, okay, maybe partially what I, maybe this is helpful, what I like about Jarman's Jubilee is there's a certain kind of queer militancy. Yeah. And I think this is definitely controversial because, you know, people are executed in that film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's made in 1978. It was called Jubilee because it was Queen Elizabeth II's Silver Jubilee. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's, you know, killed in this film. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I was thinking a lot about, you know, internet kill switches and different metaphors of kind of killing and thinking about like the dead end. Like, I feel like the literal political dead end of post-internet, just like how it actually is not a framework where you can kind of think the alternative.
Yeah.
Unless you want to reinvent and configure post-internet through something how Gibson Graham described what post-capitalism means for them. Yeah. That'd be a completely different configuration. Totally. But yeah, I think there's just like, I love this kind of idea of bringing this frame of queer militancy mm-hmm. to Silicon Valley,
yep.
you know, and kind of just like, I mean, like, I guess having my way with Silicon Valley, like within that framework where you have, like tech executives have been killed, like literature that Silicon Valley tech executives are, you know, elated by is like burning in piles, you know, techies are getting rounded up. And yeah, I think that it just, again, kind of allowed for this definitely a queer critique that kind of straddles these lines, I think, of like genuine militancy, but also something like quite playful.
Can you talk a little bit about the actors in the film? Because I think Castles, who you just mentioned, has a really incredible performance, as does Susanna.
Saxa,
thank you. And kind of how you thought about working with them as actors and how they kind of maybe help shape the framework of the film itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, in so many ways they made the film, and I feel so deeply, you know, grateful to them that they agreed to, you know, work with me on this project. And Castles is an LA-based trans performance artist that has done so much work over the years with transforming their bodies in different ways to do certain kinds of like critiques around, you know, kind of norms of gender. Mm-hmm. And I definitely kind of, yeah, I think I just always, I think ever since Castles planted that idea of being amyl nitrate in my head, I just started to kind of see them as this contra-prophet in this kind of occupied Silicon Valley, where like the kind of physical presence of Castles definitely seems to be someone that could overthrow a figure like Peter Thiel. Mm-hmm. And then working with Susanna, well, I guess maybe what I should say about that is, you know, I really liked the way Jarman kind of worked in Jubilee, where there were certain queer figures that would play roles such as Queen Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that, you know, a queer performer like Susanna kind of comes in and like occupies the role of Ayn Rand. And I think I always like to think of, I've spent so much time with this footage in the film of Susanna's performance of Ayn Rand as a kind of like micro camp. Like there's like all these kind of ways, I think, of just the way that Susanna performs Ayn Rand is this like incredibly kind of like subtle undoing and exaggeration of some of her kind of complex, really fascinating tendencies, such as taking drugs.
I mean, there's these really brilliant ways that you sort of like, I don't know, criticize the sort of false utopias of Silicon Valley and the kind of very strange blend that it has between, you know, thinking about these sort of liberatory forces and forms of freedom versus all the kind of really conservative things that are underpinned by the sort of structure of how their industry developed, I would say. But I guess I'm thinking in particular about bringing in Ayn Rand as a figure and how you kind of mobilize that in the film and things like nootropics and this kind of sort of obsession with like psychedelia and kind of getting your mind to this other state. Can you talk a little bit? I mean, there's so many brilliant little details like this in the film, but could you maybe take us through a few things like that and how you mobilize them?
Yeah, maybe I'll just talk about one, which is the world. Okay. And I think there's a lot of representations of worlds and globes in the film. And I guess how that connects to Ayn Rand is through, you know, one of her most well-known books, Atlas Shrugged. And, you know, the figure of Atlas is often understood as, right, this kind of mythical figure that holds the weight of the world. Although I think it's more correctly that he holds the weight of the heavens, but often talked of as like, you know, holding the weight of the world. And, you know, in Atlas Shrugged, one of the characters basically says, you know, well, Atlas should shrug at the world. And this kind of aligns with, you know, Ayn Rand's principles of, you know, individuality, kind of pursuing individual ideals and desires and not kind of having kind of engagement with taking care of society. So I think, you know, the way this moves into Silicon Valley, because it's well known at this point that Ayn Rand's writing has had a deep influence on many Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and figures, is that right, the idea is that, well, now kind of global information infrastructure kind of holds the weight of the world. So, you know, individuals don't have to. And I think since we've talked so much about the 90s, I think this also connects to something what Al Gore would talk about, you know, when he was kind of talking in the 90s about the coming World Wide Web or the global information infrastructure. And the whole point was, right, once this arrives, we will have, you know, kind of like global democracy, basically, that like that this kind of structure, because it will enable us to communicate, in a particularly like, you know, supposed horizontal way, it will inherently bring more equality and more democracy to the world. And I think, you know, part of what the film is trying to show is the kind of like wreckage and maybe like bankruptcy of that kind of position, where it shows when, right, the world is assumed to be held by infrastructure, what that ends up playing out, or how that ends up playing out.
Is there anything else you want to say?
I'll say that, so both of Ayn Rand's major books come up in the film. So with Atlas Shrugged, it's definitely around all these representations of the world. The way the Fountainhead emerges is through the dance sequence we see, which is, let's say, a kind of contrasexual queering of the Fountainhead, where you have tassels as nootropics dancing in a kind of gridded, networked, where like a kind of totalized network world, where a kind of battle is ensuing. And they're dancing to a song by Andrea Bocelli, which was chosen because it's one of Elon Musk's favorite songs that he claimed that described, for him, kind of captures the beauty of the world. And nootropics has a CG dildo, and this dildo is kind of spurting some kind of black purplish liquid, like a dildo fountain. So the dildo fountain is definitely my way of, let's say, seizing back the idea of the Fountainhead.
Thank you so much, Zach.
Thanks, Laurel.